at social situations. I have no idea any of this is happening. If I notice anything amiss, I just assume I'm stressed out. From the heat, from the exertion of the trip, from the noise and activity of life with my grandsons. All I need is to get back to my own house and my regular schedule, which is much less hectic than theirs. I long for peace and quiet. I miss Mirek, and I can't wait to be home with him. I leave New Haven on May the 29th, the day after I erupted at Sebastian. My shaken daughter and grandchildren escort me to the train station. As I kiss them goodbye, I know I will miss them, yet I'm eager to get home. The journey back is uneventful, and Mirek meets me at Union Station. From a distance, I easily spot his car, a green Volkswagen Passat outfitted with a roof rack for our bikes. As I step off the train, he is beaming. "I'm so happy to see you," he says, leaning in for a kiss. "I missed you." I don't kiss him back. "I'm very tired," I snap. "I want to go home." He gives me a puzzled look, tinged with hurt. "Did anything bad happen?" he asks. "I'm sure you had a wonderful time, no?" "Why are you asking me these questions now? I'm tired." He retreats into silence, but I pursue him. "You always ask me so many questions," I hiss. "What's wrong with you?" His eyes are glistening. "Are those tears?" "I don't care." Mirek says nothing more. We drive home in total silence. 5. Poisoned. As June arrives, I return to the routine of what's become normal life for me. A never-ending parade of doctors and medical appointments, even as I continue to work full-time. At the office, I find the minor shortcomings of my employees very irritating. But instead of letting these small things slide, as I normally would, I begin to criticize them frequently. "Of course I find things irritating," I tell myself. "I'm tired of being sick. I'm tired of my rash, my swollen arm. I'm tired of everything." And my headache continues to come and go. When the date finally arrives for the physical therapy appointment for my lymphedema, I don't feel like going. Although my arm is still uncomfortable, I loathe the idea of another hospital, another treatment. These medical visits are relentless reminders that I'm ill. And this visit is especially irksome now, when I'm trying to feel hopeful. My melanoma will retreat in the face of the magnificent, novel treatment I'm receiving. I know it. But I'm a woman of my word, so rather than cancel at the last minute, I keep the appointment and go. It's a short drive along back roads to the hospital from my home. Afterward, I'll head directly to work. I know our local hospital well. I've been there many times for the various minor surgeries that Mirek, Vitek, and I have endured over the past 30 years. But today, as I pull into the entrance to the parking complex, I wonder if I'm in the right place. Everything looks totally unfamiliar. I don't remember the parking area having this layout. Did they change it? I drive into the large, multi-level garage. There are no spaces on the first floor, so I continue skyward. I drive up, up, looping for what seems like forever, in circle upon circle, onto higher and higher levels. But still, I find no empty parking spots. I emerge at the very top of the garage, where I'm momentarily dazzled by the sunshine. "In this heat, the car will be unbearable when I return," I say to myself as I park. I take the stairs down, down, down to the first floor of the garage. But once I'm there, I can't locate the hospital entrance. Did this change too? I wander about for a minute and finally discover the front door. But once inside, I find myself in a confusing maze of long corridors leading in all directions, lined with doors opening to who knows where. I'm lost again. Have they changed everything in this place? Irritation wells inside me. Why did I have to come here? This is so stupid. I grumble. Where's the office? Why don't they make it easier for patients to find their way around? I ask several people for directions, but no matter how much they try to help, I cannot find the physical therapy department. I cannot believe they're doing this to me. I'm sick. How could they put me through this? Somehow, I finally stumble upon the front desk of the PT department. I am seething. After checking in, I take a seat in the waiting area, but any relief I feel at having found the office quickly dissolves. On the couch across from me, a little boy is coughing and crying. He nags his dad to take him out of the room. I stare at the child with annoyance. Why on earth would they let a sick child into this room? I'm very ill. I can't afford to be around someone like him. As he continues to cry, my loathing increases. Isn't physical therapy for adults? Sick children should have a separate clinic. They should be isolated. He's going to infect me. I hate the little boy. I hate his father. I hate this place. This torment continues for a long while until, at last, a woman in hospital scrubs enters the waiting room and calls my name. I'm Teresa, she says with a smile. It's nice to meet you. Such a strained, dishonest smile. So insincere. What is she up to? I better keep a close eye on her. She leads me into an examination room and offers me a seat, then begins to inspect my arm. The lymphedema is really advanced, she says. You've waited way too long. The swelling may be permanent. I'm going to explain how we should treat it so that it doesn't get worse, but you have to follow my instructions very carefully. If you don't, it could be dangerous to your health. Your arm will be prone to infections. Why is she droning on and on? This is such a dreary, boring, awful place. I begin to wonder what we'll have for dinner tonight. Did Mirek get the salmon from the grocery store? I'll bet he forgot. He's always forgetting everything I ask him to do. How could he... Her voice momentarily interrupts my thoughts. Let me show you how to bandage the arm, she says. You'll wear this bandage for the next month or two. It's very important. Do you understand? What time is it? I need to get home, especially if Mirek forgot to shop. I need to get dinner ready. She eyes me. You really need to do this, she says firmly. I pretend to listen. After you're done with the bandage, you'll be using a compression sleeve like this, she says, holding out a long flesh-coloured tube designed to span the length of an arm from knuckles to armpit. You will have to wear another sleeve at night to keep your arm compressed and prevent lymph fluid from pooling. I glance at the sleeve. It's ugly and silly. Are you kidding? I scoff. Do you really expect me to wear that ridiculous thing? Looks like a medieval torture device. She doesn't respond. Who does she think she is, sitting there so smugly? I'm a professional woman with great responsibilities, I continue. How on earth would I look wearing these ridiculous bandages and sleeves? They may be good enough for someone sitting at home all day, but not for me. I work in a serious place. I supervise a large department. You must have something better than that. She keeps watching me, silent. I know better than she does. Why don't you just massage my arm and let's be done with it? I propose. Massage will only work in combination with these compression sleeves, she says. This is a serious condition. It needs immediate attention and ongoing treatment. I don't like her expression. She's arrogant. I knew it the minute I saw that fake smile. I'm not going to wear anything on my arm, I say. Forget it. You need a series of regular visits, she insists, and you have to stop arguing with me. A series of visits? I start to laugh. I've no time for such bullshit. I stand up and give her a withering look, then wheel around and stomp out of the door, through the waiting room and into the hallway. What kind of nonsense was that? I say aloud as I leave. What a waste of time this was. I'm never coming back. Appalling. They have absolutely no idea what they're doing. I find the stairs in the parking garage and march directly to the highest floor, all the way into the sun. I get into my car and accelerate down and out of the parking garage in a long, spiraling swoop. Finally, I can head to work. I'm determined to put this absurdity behind me and get on with my day. By this time, the highway is no longer congested by rush hour traffic. Of course, there are no cars on the highway anymore. Everyone's at work. I would be too if I hadn't spent well over an hour in that stupid hospital. It's an easy drive on the beltway to the sprawling NIMH campus in Bethesda. This is the largest biomedical institution in the world. Almost 21,000 federal employees work in dozens of buildings situated on hundreds of acres of a former private estate. Even though I'm exhausted by that pointless physical therapy appointment, I put in a long day at work, supervising all aspects of the brain bank. I'm bombarded with questions as soon as I arrive. One of the technicians asks about a potential brain and whether we should accept it. As soon as he leaves, another technician comes in with a similar query. After she leaves, I respond to a dozen emails from researchers around the country, eager to receive some of our brain samples. And then I review the most recent data about the tissue samples we are storing. Each time I get up and head into the lab to check on my employees, I pass by a bowl of chocolates on my assistant's desk. She always has candy out, and I always avoid it. I don't like to eat unhealthily, especially sweets. But yesterday the chocolates looked so good that I ate them throughout the day. I couldn't stop. Today it's the same. Every time I walk by, I grab another one and pop it in my mouth. Sweets have never tasted so irresistible. Early one evening, a few days after the physical therapy appointment, I'm in the kitchen, chopping vegetables and slicing meat to make a stir-fry for our dinner. I'm sipping a glass of wine, trying to relax, when I hear a knock on our front door. Mirek is upstairs working in his office, so I answer it. A man about 30 years old, with a broad smile, is standing on the front step. "Hello, Mrs. Lipska," he says brightly. How weird. He acts like he knows me. I've never seen this man before. What does he want? Something is very wrong. I can sense it. Something dangerous. Without waiting for my invitation, he steps forward as if to enter our house. I block the door. "I'm John," he says, "from pest control." He holds out his hand. I don't shake it. "Who?" I demand. "John. We provide pest control services for you, remember?" He's definitely up to something. "We've been providing termite inspection service to you for over 20 years, he says, speaking more slowly now. That change in his voice, he knows I'm on to him. "This is our scheduled visit," he continues. "May I do the inspection?" "The inspection? Oh, really?" I make sure my sarcasm is clear. "Why are you here today, exactly?" He gives me a puzzled look. "What," I ask again, "do you think you're going to do?" He starts to talk about termites. That reminds me of something urgent. "Ants!" I shout. "They're everywhere!" I dash into the kitchen. "Come, look here, and here!" I point at the windowsill, where a few tiny ants are marching along the wall to the back door that opens onto the outside deck. "Ants, see? And you absolutely have to see the stain on the wall in the basement. It might be mould." My words pour out in a torrent. "Go, look, quickly!" He rushes downstairs to the basement. I'm relieved to be rid of him, but a few minutes later he returns, talking about something or other. The only word I hear is chemicals. He's going to spray some chemicals. "Chemicals!" I jump as if someone's poked me. "What do you mean, chemicals?" He looks scared. I knew it. I've caught him. "Our chemicals are very effective against ants and fungus," he says. But his speech is halting and uncertain. Aha! His little game is up. "We have another spray for the termites." He pauses and then adds, "Don't worry, they're all very safe." "Safe? Chemicals?" I shout. "Chemicals are poison. Don't you know that? How can you say that they're safe?" Well, customer safety is key to our... Then tell me, what's in these chemicals? I demand. What compounds do you use? He stares at me blankly. I have him cornered. You have no idea, do you? Safe? Ha! I'm a chemist. You can't fool me. I have young grandsons. Are you trying to poison them? To poison us all? Is that your plan? All chemicals are toxic. I forbid you to use any chemicals in this house. Somebody approaches behind me, and I realize that Mirek has come down the stairs. Hello, how are you? Mirek says to the young man. Why is Mirek greeting him so cordially? This stranger is trying to poison us. Mirek turns to me. Don't worry, he won't do anything today, he says soothingly. He'll just do the inspection. Here, I'll sign the papers. Mirek turns to some documents the young man has placed on the kitchen island. No way! I shout, inserting myself between him and the island. I lean in toward the young man and yell, You are fired! His face is frozen in disbelief. Before Mirek can say anything, I continue, Not only are you not working for us anymore, but I'm going to call your manager and tell him that you are totally incompetent. How can you not know the chemical composition of your own spray? Unbelievable. What an idiot. I turn and storm away, leaving Mirek and the stranger alone in the kitchen. These kinds of changes in normal behaviour often signal that something serious is occurring inside a person's brain. My emotional overreactions, anger, suspicion, impatience, suggest that my frontal lobe is undergoing catastrophic changes. But these warning signs are lost on me. As an expert on mental illness, I, more than most people, should be able to see that I'm acting strangely. But I can't. Although I don't know it yet, my 6 tumours and the swelling around them are shutting down the frontal cortex, the part of the brain that allows for self-reflection. Paradoxically, I need my frontal cortex in order to understand that mine has gone missing. This inability to recognize my own impairment is often observed in people with mental disorders. Known as anosognosia, or lack of insight, it's a feature of many neurological and psychiatric conditions. Little is known about which brain regions are responsible for lack of insight. But some investigators suggest that it may be related to dysfunctions in the midline of the brain, which separates the right and left hemispheres. Damage to the right hemisphere may also be involved. In schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, a lack of insight into one's condition is thought to be a manifestation of the illness itself, rather than denial or a coping mechanism, as it may initially seem to be. About 50% of people with schizophrenia and 40% with bipolar disorder cannot understand that they are sick, so they have no real awareness of their condition and won't accept their diagnoses. If they experience hallucinations or delusions, they don't see them as a sign that something is wrong with their brains. Even the most dramatic symptoms, such as hearing voices or believing that they are God, are indistinguishable from reality. Because people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder who suffer from a lack of insight don't believe they are ill, they're often very resistant to psychiatric treatment. They may not take prescribed medications or participate in behavioural therapies. And there's no cure at present for this kind of lack of insight. Just like someone with schizophrenia, I don't think that there's something seriously wrong with me. I think I'm absolutely fine mentally. If anything, I believe I'm just stressed or tired, worn out by the poor design of a medical facility or the inexcusable wailing of a child in a hospital waiting room, by the appearance of a strange, pushy man at my front door. I do not connect these dots or deduce that the problem is in my head rather than some place beyond it. I have no reason to think that my reactions to these incidents might be related to my tumours or cancer treatment, nor does anyone around me. At this point, I'm not getting any MRIs, which would reveal what is happening inside my brain. And so, as my confusion grows, my brain fills in the gaps between what's in my head and what's happening around me with conspiracy theories. I become increasingly suspicious of my family and my colleagues at work, and increasingly dissatisfied by everyone's performance of even simple tasks. I'm certain that people, especially the members of my family, are plotting against me. Kasia doesn't really like me anymore. I don't think Mirek does either. Why are they talking about me? I can tell they're hiding things from me. But what? What are they hiding? Feelings of suspicion, sometimes rising to the level of paranoia, can be a symptom of many types of mental illness, including Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's patients may accuse their romantic partners of cheating on them, or their caretakers of stealing property, or trying to harm or even kill them. While neuroscientists don't really understand the networks or parts of the brain related to paranoia, in some cases, this condition is attributed to temporal lobe damage. And while the turmoil in my brain may be responsible for my behavioral overreactions, it's true that my feelings are not completely irrational. I have good reason to be suspicious. After all, my worried family is talking about the way I'm acting. To their dismay, all of my least likable characteristics, my need for organization, my insistence on doing things my way, are growing more exaggerated as the days go by. I'm becoming the worst version of myself, selfish and unconcerned about other people's feelings. I've lost empathy, the trait that was always so strong in me. Whereas once I listened patiently to Kasia on the phone as she described her workday or challenges with the kids, I now cut her off. I'm losing my emotional connection to the people closest to me, especially my caring husband. Why are some people highly empathic while others are profoundly selfish? Like so much about human behavior, we don't know for sure. Empathy, like other complex behaviors, is not situated in one isolated part of the brain, but regulated by a wide network of connections among many brain regions. An intricate mix of genetic and environmental factors are probably at work. How each brain is structured and internally connected, how a person is brought up, and where and in what culture he or she is raised. Each individual's personality is a result of complex interactions among countless factors that influence the brain's function. However, some scientists think that some brain regions may be more involved in empathy than others, and these include the frontal cortex, the temporal lobe, and the insula, a cortical region located deep inside the brain between the frontal and temporal lobes. If that's true, it may explain why loss of empathy is often a core symptom of a kind of dementia called frontotemporal dementia, FTD, which is caused by a progressive and ultimately fatal neurodegenerative disease. Dementia is a broad term that refers to certain mental declines, such as loss of memory and social and cognitive abilities, that are serious enough to interfere with daily life and that have lasted at least 12 months. The most common cause of dementia is Alzheimer's disease, which accounts for 60 to 80% of all dementia cases and is characterized by lapses in memory, language, or executive functioning. Certain other neurodegenerative diseases also cause dementia, and so can stroke, traumatic brain injury, and infections such as syphilis and HIV. The World Health Organization estimates that roughly 47 million people worldwide suffer from dementia of some kind, with nearly 10 million new cases diagnosed each year. Since my symptoms are so new and transient, I don't come close to meeting the criteria for dementia. But some of the personality changes I've begun to experience during the trip to New Haven are similar to those seen in cases of frontotemporal dementia, which, as its name suggests, affects the frontal and temporal lobes. FTD typically strikes people at a younger age than Alzheimer's, with 60% of cases occurring in people 45 to 64 years old, that is, in middle age. Because the frontal lobe is involved, patients often become disinhibited and lose their judgment, and it is sadly apt that FTD is sometimes called the midlife crisis disease. Some people become sexually inappropriate. Some go on wild shopping sprees, become financially irresponsible, or eat junk food with abandon. They may behave as if their ids are running amok with no superegos to override their impulses and desires. People with FTD typically lack empathy and also are convinced that they're doing nothing wrong. This lack of insight is a core criterion for FTD and for many other mental disorders, including schizophrenia, the disease I have spent so much of my life studying. While I don't have frontotemporal dementia or schizophrenia, the swelling in my brain is causing me to act like someone with mental illness. I'm here in body, but not always in mind. The people around me recognize me, yet don't. They are struggling to understand why I could possibly be behaving so strangely, and I am oblivious to their concerns. The world around me seems more and more peculiar, and my confusion often morphs into anger. Everything that everyone does is so irritating, more than irritating, infuriating. What's the matter with everyone at work? Why can't they do things the right way? Why is it always up to me to correct their mistakes? Mirek isn't any better. Everything he does is wrong. And no matter how much I point it out, he keeps screwing things up. It's unbelievable. My complaints are relentless. Why did you put a napkin here and not there? It makes no sense, I say to Mirek as I'm preparing dinner. Or, why are you still sitting? Don't you see that I need your help right now? Each time I snap at him, he gently asks me to calm down. I hate that. It's so stupid and weak. It just makes me angrier. Why is Mirek such a wimp? What happened to him? He frets over my health, always asking me if I need anything, urging me to do the things I enjoy, to go for a run or take a bike ride. It irritates me. More and more I avoid his eyes. I don't care how it affects him. I don't care what he's thinking or feeling. I don't care what he's going through at work or anywhere else. I have more important things to focus on. What will I have for breakfast? Is the table setting complete? And now Mirek has put the forks somewhere that I can't find them. Why would he do this to me? Where's the salt? I can't remember what I was planning for dinner. For the life of me, I just cannot recall. It really bothers me. And where is Mirek? Bothered by my short temper and egotism, my family tiptoes around me, and out of earshot, they quietly share their concerns. Upstairs in his office, on one occasion that I will learn about much later, Mirek speaks with Kasia on the phone, telling her that I'm being difficult, so difficult that he is really struggling. She can tell that he's trying hard not to cry. I'm not the same woman they've always known, they agree. I'm an angry, overly critical, selfish version of myself. My characteristics are basically the same, for the most part, but exaggerated. I'm an over-the-top caricature of myself. But my behavior is not so bizarre that it sends up red flags about my health. I've always spoken my mind, more so than anyone in the family. They're used to that. And my concern about the chemicals and the pesticides, for example, wasn't unreasonable, they admit. Chemicals can be dangerous after all. So the fact I ripped into the pest control guy wasn't completely out of line. So my awful behaviour continues unchecked. And for my part, I remain unaware that anything is amiss. With a brain that's not functioning properly, I am singularly focused on my own needs and entirely blind to the signals that something is seriously wrong with me. There is one thing I care about more than anything else: getting that fourth and final infusion. I'm going to finish this treatment even if I have to drive myself to the hospital. even if I have to walk the 20 miles to get there, crawl into the infusion unit and stick the IV into my own vein. I'll do it. I'll do whatever it takes. 6. Lost. At the office, I work long hours, just as I did before my diagnosis. I act like nothing is different. I review scientific articles and manage my large staff, making detailed plans for the Institute's ever-expanding brain bank. We continue collecting post-mortem brains and setting up scientific collaborations with colleagues across the country at a faster and faster pace to support increased demand as more people in the scientific community learn about our brain bank. I assure my supervisors that I'm back to normal, and I send emails with cheery subject lines like, "I am feeling good." And I am feeling good. I'm staying optimistic about my prospect of surviving this deadly cancer. While I'm no longer as strong as I was before I began immunotherapy, I'm still capable of powering through a normal workday, and, when the occasion calls for it, summoning great bursts of energy for a project or a meeting. I believe I'm doing very well, apart from the tumours in my brain. But, of course, I'm not. Increasingly, I struggle with some tasks, and I'm having trouble focusing on what I'm doing. Reading is especially confusing. I begin delegating some of my work to my employees and sending emails in all caps, the electronic version of shouting, something I've never done before. On one occasion, instead of proofreading an article for a prominent academic journal myself, as I've always done, I immediately forward it via email to a postdoc with a blunt note, "Please do this." Another time, I emailed the organisers of a professional conference whom I'd asked to make hotel reservations for me. "Thanks. These are super special circumstances for me. I am battling a deadly disease. As a federal employee, I have to wait for travel approval and can only use GovRate Fee H. For hotel, I tried to ask for accommodation a few weeks ago, BIY, to Mo Avail. Please help. Thanks, Barbarak." I see nothing amiss with this email, and no one says anything to me about it. Nor do I recognize that I'm becoming more and more uncaring about what other people think, and more disinhibited. At some point in June, for instance, I stop pulling down the blinds in the bathroom window at home when I'm showering. I just stop caring about who might see me. It's just too much work. And why would I block a nice view into the park? It's around this time, in June, that I go for a run through the neighbourhood without my prosthetic breast and with hair dye dripping all over me, surprising Mirek with my bizarre appearance when I return home. I see nothing off about the way I look. I don't realise what's happening at the time, but this lack of inhibition and judgement are common in people with frontal lobe problems due to dementia, stroke, injury, swelling in the brain, or any number of issues. The frontal lobes give us the capacity to predict the consequences of our behaviour and avoid actions with expected adverse reactions. Each of us makes thousands of judgment calls every day, in most cases without even having to think about them. When a person suddenly breaks normal social rules, as I'm doing now, it's a strong indication that the frontal lobe is not working properly. Without a functional frontal lobe, my brain is like a horse galloping dangerously after the rider has lost the reins. More and more, I just do what I want when I want to do it. I don't notice anything awry, and if I do, I don't care. One hot and humid day in mid-June, I head to work in the early morning to avoid driving in heavy traffic, because driving has become increasingly confusing. By late afternoon, I'm exhausted. I've worked all day without a break, trying to make up for lost hours spent at doctor's appointments and hooked up to the IV to receive my immunotherapy drugs. I look outside and see heavy, dark clouds gathering over the high-rises of the NIMH campus. It's going to pour soon. I'm irritated by the weather and so, so tired. I have to leave. I have to leave right now. I bolt from my office to the multi-level garage where I always park and head to the same spot I always use. My space is usually open when I get to work because I always arrive early, often before the garage has any cars at all. The garage I use is not the one closest to the building where I work, but I like to take a little walk at the start and then again at the end of my day. For many years, I had limited need for these ugly concrete constructions to park my car. Whenever the weather allowed, I biked to work, about 20 miles each way on a peaceful, tree-lined trail along the Potomac River. But no more. Since my brain surgery and the immunotherapy, I don't have the same energy and stamina. So I drive to work, although I hate it. I feel reduced to a lesser version of myself. But at least I have a lovely walk to relax and unwind after a day in the office. After 10 minutes, I reach the garage. But I don't see my silver Toyota RAV4 in my regular spot. That's weird. I don't remember having to park somewhere new today. I was in early, like I always am. Wasn't I? I walk up one aisle and down another. The garage is full, but my Toyota is nowhere to be found. I search each floor, trudging back and forth, scanning the rows of cars. I'm concerned, then very worried. Someone stole my car. Or maybe I just... I don't know. Maybe I parked somewhere new and don't recall it. I reach into my purse and pull out the car key. I press the alarm button and hear a beep. It's coming from far off. I walk toward the sound, pressing the button from time to time to make another beep, then another. What is happening? It makes no sense at all. I retrace my steps, go back to where I started, and press the button on my key again. I hear the beep once more. But when I walk toward the sound, I can't hear it anymore. I try the same thing over and over. Press, beep, nothing. I can't locate my car. I'm confused and lost. I don't understand what is going on. I don't understand the world. It's playing tricks on me, strange and cruel tricks. I see a woman walking in my direction. I hesitate for a moment before approaching her. How embarrassing to admit that I'm having trouble finding my car. But I have no other option. I'm tired of walking around in this dark space. I want to go home. Can you help me find my car? I ask. I don't know where I parked. She looks surprised, but says she will help. She takes my key, presses the button, and we hear the beep. It must be halfway up on the higher floor, she says. Look up there, through the gap between the floors. There, in the opening she's pointing to, I see my silver Toyota. It seems to be on the ramp between the first and second floors. I have no idea how it got there. I grab my keys from her and run up the ramp to my car. It's flashing its lights, as if winking its eyes at me to say, "Gotcha!" I'm relieved, but confused. Why is it parked here? I don't remember pulling into this spot. Is it possible someone moved it? Why would they do that? My confusion only grows when I climb into the Toyota. I've been driving this car for 3 years, but when I get into it and try to fasten my seatbelt, I can't seem to find it. I extend my hand, as I always do, to pull down the strap, but there's no seatbelt where I expect it to be. Instead, my outstretched hand dangles outside the door, hitting nothing but air. I try again. The same thing happens. There is nothing to grab, nothing to hold on to. No seatbelt, no anything. Why am I having so much trouble with everything I try to do? The world around me feels odd and awkward, with cars the most deceitful part of all. I no longer understand how to do the simplest things connected to them. I look around and still can't find the seatbelt. Instead, I notice that my door is wide open. It shouldn't be open, I realize, but I can't recall what that has to do with the missing seatbelt. I sit for a while, and then, irritated, I slam the door with a bang. With that noise, my world returns to normal, like magic. I slide my right hand across the inside of the closed door, and it easily locates the seatbelt. I reach for it. It's in its normal position, right there, hanging from the fastener on the inside of the car. I pull it toward me and across my chest, slide the buckle into its locking mechanism, and click. Finally, it works. I'm ready to go. I start the engine and try to back out, but I get stuck. Something is holding the car in place. I can't move. I push harder on the gas pedal and hear a ghastly screeching sound of metal scraping something hard. I hit the brakes and look to my left. Somehow I'm partially wedged under a small truck parked next to me. My wheel or some part of my car seems to be stuck under the truck, but I'm not sure how or why it got there. I try to drive forward. The screeching intensifies. I put my car in reverse. The same thing happens. In desperation, I press really hard on the gas pedal, ignoring the terrifying noise of smashing and screeching and breaking objects, and finally free myself from the trap. As I pull away, I see that my car's left side is dented, but I don't check the damage to the truck. I don't care. I simply drive away. I head toward the exit. It's clearly visible from a distance, so I drive in that direction. Although the exit driveway is narrow and slightly curved, it's never given me any trouble. I've passed easily through it hundreds and hundreds of times. When I reach it today, though, it seems much narrower, almost unrecognizable. I drive slowly, trying to squeeze through the constricted exit. But I cannot fit. What are they doing with these driveways? Changing everything, constant construction on this stupid campus. Why did they alter the exit? I hear loud scratching and a bang as I run over a high curb. The parking attendant runs out of his booth. "Lady, what are you doing?" he shouts. "What do you think?" I mutter, increasingly irritated. "I'm just trying to get out of here, to leave this ridiculous garage and go home." Standing in front of my car, he points with his hands, directing my moves so I can free my wheels, as one of them is stuck high up on the curb. Finally, I pull loose. I drive off angrily. I have the uneasy feeling that the world is plotting against me. As if to confirm that, as I head home, the sky opens and it begins to pour. At this time of year in Northern Virginia, the rains are often intense, almost tropical in their suddenness. Visibility during such weather is minimal. The world hides behind a curtain of water that is grey, foggy, and shapeless. Although the sun won't set for another several hours, it's dark and I see nothing but rain. I can't even make out the outline of the hood of my car. The houses, the highway railing, even the other cars, all seem to wash off in the rain. I'm driving blind. Home is somewhere out there, a hidden oasis in the woods facing a quiet street. It's my cradle of safety. I need to get there quickly. Then I'll be fine. But it's nearly 20 miles away. I turn onto a busy four-lane road. Cars whiz by me at unusually high speeds. Why are they going so dangerously fast? I creep along to the correct exit and merge onto the main highway, the beltway that snakes through the suburbs of Maryland and Virginia. From there it should be simple. I've taken this route countless times. But today it looks different. Why can't I figure out where I am? Is it the rain that makes it so difficult? I need the exit onto Little River Turnpike West, but I don't see it. Have I already taken the exit? Why can't I remember? Am I lost? I'm not sure. I don't really have any idea where I am. But I do see that I'm no longer on the highway. I keep driving. Instead of the familiar streets and houses of my neighborhood, I'm going past a huge shopping mall. Gray buildings, expansive parking lots, entrances to dark garages, What am I doing here? How did I get into this gloomy shopping mall somewhere I've never seen before? I feel as if I've skipped through time or leaped into another reality. It's odd. But I'm not worried much, and I'm not afraid. It's like I'm a character in a movie mysteriously transported in a rainstorm to a place I didn't intend to go. Nothing is what it seems. Nothing works as it should. I want to get home, but I don't know what to do. I stop by the side of the road, then pull into a vast parking lot. I fumble with my cell phone. I know that I have an app that will guide me home, but I cannot recall which one it is. I stare at the many icons on the screen, but none of them are familiar. I randomly press the button on this one and that, but nothing's helping. After a long while, I see the Waze icon and press it, and when it speaks its directions, I again begin to drive. Eventually, I pass by a large construction site with a building that extends along an entire block. It looks shiny and new and seems like it's almost complete. A huge sign announces that a giant supermarket is soon to open. A giant! How wonderful! I wish they would build a new giant near us. Oh, wait, look! It is in our neighborhood! I'm back in our neighborhood! This giant will be ours! My happiness quickly deflates. Yes, this will be our new neighborhood grocery store. But will it be mine? Will I live to see it open? Now I'm in my driveway. I have no idea how I got here. It's becoming more and more difficult for my brain to function normally. Increasingly, I find it a struggle to carry out ordered, sequential movements. I can no longer execute simple tasks that I've done many times before, or organize them in my mind in a methodical fashion. By itself, each step is very familiar, but combined together, they are as challenging as the complex experiments I used to carry out in my labs. I know that I can't drive without wearing a seatbelt, and I vaguely know where the seatbelt is supposed to be, but I can't perform the basic steps to buckle it, steps that were automatic for me only days ago. What part of my brain isn't working? It's likely that communication between my prefrontal cortex and my hippocampus is failing, which is unpleasantly reminiscent of the prefrontal cortical connections I disrupted in rats to study schizophrenia. Perhaps the areas that aren't functioning normally could be determined if I were to undergo a battery of neuropsychological tests as my problems intensify. But no one is testing me like I tested my rats, in controlled experiments carefully designed to examine particular elements of the behavioral impairments. Still, I share some similarities to my brain-damaged rodents. I can't find my way in the maze of streets in my cozy neighborhood, and I cannot locate the sweet rewards of food and safety that are waiting for me at my destination. In some ways, my struggles are similar to those of people who have a condition called dyspraxia, the loss of motor skills, motor memory, and the ability to perform coordinated movements. Dyspraxia can be due to a developmental disorder. The actor Daniel Radcliffe has been open about his struggles with it. Dyspraxia is also quite common among people with Alzheimer's disease, and the symptoms can be progressive. First, patients have trouble with sophisticated motor skills, and later, they are unable to do simple things such as brush their teeth. Eventually, some can't even swallow. These kinds of difficulties are also common in people with damage to the parietal cortex. The parietal lobe is also related to the ability to read and do math. Dyspraxia often coexists with dyslexia and dyscalculia, difficulty doing arithmetic, something I will soon begin to experience as well. This could have suggested, if we'd thought about it at the time, that my brain problems were more widespread than any of us imagined. In addition to dyspraxia, I'm also suffering from loss of visuospatial memory, which makes it hard for me to remember my location and navigate my way through space. These problems are similar to those described in people with a condition called developmental topographical disorientation, DTD. From very early on in their lives, perhaps from birth, people with DTD don't recognize very familiar environments. Just as I could not find my way home in a place where I've lived for almost 30 years, people with DTD have no recognition of their surroundings, no matter how many times they follow the same route. For me, this was short and transient. For them, it is permanent. Spatial orientation involves multiple regions of the brain and a network of connections among neurons in different areas. Two regions, however, stand out as crucial for spatial memory: the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus. In the case of DTD, it may be the connectivity between these two regions that has gone awry, as MRI scans have demonstrated to neuroscientists who study this rare neurological disorder. Is this what is happening with me? It's possible. My prefrontal cortex appears to be dysfunctional, and perhaps can't connect efficiently with other brain regions, including the hippocampus, one of its main, albeit indirect, targets. It's possible that the lack of communication between these two regions in my brain is the reason why I cannot figure out where I am, even when driving through a neighborhood where I've lived for decades. My changed behaviors do not raise enough red flags for my family and colleagues to wonder whether my brain may be seriously malfunctioning. For one thing, I'm not telling my family the whole truth about every single problem I encounter. I don't even tell them about how I smash the car. The lapses in how I usually act can be, and are, easily discounted and explained by the stresses of my grim diagnosis, challenging treatment, responsibilities of family and career. And regardless, I'm still functioning at a very high level, which is remarkable given what my family, my doctors, and I are about to learn about the shocking reality of what's happening in my brain. 7. Inferno. This headache is killing me. Dull and throbbing like distant thunder, it overwhelms me, taking over not only my head, but my entire being. The clock in my bedroom shows that it's the middle of the night. I lie in bed, wide awake. Somewhere deep inside my body, I feel an approaching storm. All of a sudden, lightning strikes. My stomach turns upside down. Nausea overcomes me, and I leap from bed, rush to the bathroom, lower my head over the toilet bowl, and vomit violently. My skull seems to split in half as the headache explodes, then slowly recedes. I feel better, but so weak I can't stand up. Kneeling before the toilet, I stare down at strange pieces of plastic swirling in the water. I'm terrified. It's surreal, the sight of all this plastic I vomited up. Why would they have made a pizza filled with plastic? Poison. They're poisoning us. Last night, June the 16th, we celebrated my final infusion, a finish line I'd sworn I would cross. I was elated, but very tired. I felt as if I'd just graduated from college with the highest grades in my class, or crossed the finish line of a marathon. Done with immunotherapy. After 12 weeks of hoping that I could withstand the hardships of this treatment, itchy rashes covering my body, gastrointestinal problems, the loss of thyroid function, it was over. That final hospital visit was the longest ever. Over 6 hours waiting for blood tests, waiting for the doctor, and waiting for the drugs to be delivered from the pharmacy in their transparent plastic bags, and then released very slowly, drip by drip, into my veins. Afterwards, Mirek and I were both so tired that I couldn't even consider making dinner. On the way home from the hospital, we did something we rarely do. We stopped for takeout pizza at a local restaurant. We don't go to restaurants or get takeout very often. We both prefer my cooking, one of my great pleasures. In America, I've taken advantage of the freedom of a previously unimaginable selection of foods by cooking as often as I can. I've prepared our meals for years, no matter what my day was like, no matter if I was going through chemo for breast cancer or recovering from a mastectomy or brain surgery. After every marathon and triathlon that I've ever raced, I've returned home tired but beaming with happiness and prepared our dinner. Usually it's something simple and healthy. Pasta with stir-fried vegetables and grated parmesan, baked fish, roasted potatoes, an arugula salad, chicken stir-fried with sweet peas, tomatoes and onions, and spiced with lots of hot red pepper. Mirek and I love to sit in our spacious dining room overlooking the woods, enjoying glasses of wine, or, more often, a bottle. We share the events of our day, relive a road race, discuss what I talked about with Kasia or Vitek or Maria in our daily conversations. This is our sacred time for relaxing and catching up with each other. Our dinners last at least 2 hours. To mark the end of the meal, we drink strong hot tea. Now, as I stare at the bits of plastic in the toilet, I regret the decision to break from our ritual. The restaurant filled the pizza with plastic, pieces of plastic bags, to make the pizza look bigger so they could charge more money. I should have known. The cheese was so white, weirdly white, with a crumpled texture too strange to be real food. It didn't taste like real, crunchy pizza. The bottom was soaked in some kind of odd liquid, and the top covered with chewy, inedible plastic. I'm seething. We've been poisoned. Mirek, wake up. I rush into the bedroom. The pizza. It's poison. It was made of plastic. He sits up in bed and tries to calm me. It isn't poison, he says gently. The pizza wasn't that good, but there was no plastic or anything like that in it. No, listen to me, I say. I just threw it all up. The pizza was made of plastic. I saw it floating in the toilet. The cheese was plastic. The crust was plastic. But I didn't get sick, he says soothingly. Don't you think your vomiting was a reaction to yesterday's infusion? Don't you believe me? I grow more agitated. I saw it. I saw the plastic. They are poisoning us. He gently pats my back, asks if he can get me some water. Come, lie down. Try to sleep, he urges. You'll feel better. I announce we will never eat there again. Mirek agrees. But as he falls back asleep, I lie beside him, angry and suspicious. Why won't Mirek see what's going on? Why is he defending the pizza place? In the morning, I call Kasia and tell her that the pizza place down the street tried to poison us with plastic. Mom, she says carefully, I think you should call Dr. Atkins or his nurses. I can hear the concern in her voice. Please call them. It's not me, it's the pizza place. Why won't Kasia believe me? Mom, will you please call them? She presses. No, I'm fine, I say. It was only that awful pizza. Never mind, it's already passed. On Wednesday and Thursday, I drive myself to the office in the morning and spend uneventful days at the brain bank. Thursday, after work, I go swimming at the local pool, then go food shopping. When I get home with the groceries, I tell Mirek that I'm feeling very well. But after dinner, when I sit at the computer to continue writing my life stories, Mirek notices that I'm having trouble typing. He also sees that I have no idea how much I'm struggling. I don't notice that some of my words are mangled. Mirek says nothing to me, but heads upstairs to telephone Kasia. They talk about the incident with the pizza and the splitting headache I had that night. They're very concerned about my behaviour. Early the next morning, Friday, Kasia calls me. I really think you should contact Dr. Atkins, Kasia says. I'll draft an email to him and send it to you. You can forward it to his nurses. A few minutes later, I receive the note that Kasia wants me to send. My daughter wanted to bring this up, though I feel fine. She is worried that there may be subtle changes in my driving and perhaps in thinking. Mild forgetfulness, forgetting to turn at the right intersection. This could be from